onto the king-size bed at the Hotel Georges sank, sinking into the plush feather-top mattress. You need to lie down, Charlie. This is the most delicious bed I've ever slept on. Why don't we have beds like these at the Calthorpe? We really ought to. The lumpy mattresses we have probably haven't been changed since Elizabethan times. Astrid, we can enjoy the bed later, la. We only have 3 hours left until the shops close. Come on, lazy bones. Didn't you sleep enough on the train? Charlie cajoled. He couldn't wait to show Astrid the city he had come to know like the back of his hand. His mother and sisters had discovered the world of high fashion in the decades since his father had taken his tech company public, transforming the Woos almost overnight from mere centimillionaires to billionaires. In the early days, before they were in the habit of chartering planes, Dad would buy up the entire first-class cabin of Singapore Airlines, and the whole family would sweep through the capitals of Europe, staying in the grandest hotels, eating at the restaurants with the most Michelin stars, and indulging in limitless shopping. Charlie had grown up knowing his Bucciolati from his Boucheron, and he was eager to show this world to Astrid. He knew that, for all her pedigree, Astrid had been brought up practically in a nunnery. The Leongs did not eat in expensive restaurants. They ate food prepared by their cooks at home. They did not favor dressing up in designer clothes, preferring to have everything made by their family tailor. Charlie felt that Astrid had been far too stifled. All her life she had been treated like a hothouse flower, when in fact she was a wildflower that was never allowed to bloom fully. Now that they were 18 and living together in London, they were finally free of family confines, and he would dress her like the princess she was, and she would be his forever. Charlie led Astrid straight to the Marais, a neighborhood he had discovered on his own after tiring of tagging along with his family to the same shops within a three-block radius of the Georges V. As they strolled down Rue Vieille du Temple, Astrid let out a sigh. Aïe, it's adorable here, so much cozier than those wide boulevards in the 8th arrondissement. There is one shop in particular that I stumbled on the last time I was here. It was so cool. I can just picture you wearing everything this designer makes, this tiny Tunisian guy. Let's see, which street was it on? Charlie mumbled to himself. After a few more turns, they arrived at the boutique that Charlie wanted Astrid to see. The windows consisted of smoked glass, giving nothing away as to what treasures lay within. Why don't you go in first, and I'll join you in a sec. I want to stop in at the pharmacy across the street to see if they have any camera batteries, Charlie suggested. Astrid stepped through the door and found herself transported into a parallel universe. Portuguese fado music wailed through a space with black ceilings, obsidian walls, and poured concrete floors stained a dark espresso. Minimalist industrial hooks protruded from the walls, and the clothes were artfully draped like pieces of sculpture and lit with halogen spotlights. A saleswoman with a wild, frizzy mane of red hair glanced briefly from behind an oval glass desk with elephant tusk legs, before continuing to puff on her cigarette and page through an oversized magazine. After a few minutes, when it seemed like Astrid wasn't leaving, she asked haughtily, "Can I help you?" "Oh, no, I'm just looking around, thank you," Astrid replied in her schoolgirl French. She continued to circle the space and noticed a wide set of steps leading downstairs. "Is there more downstairs?" she asked. "Of course," the saleslady said in her raspy voice, getting up from her desk reluctantly and following Astrid down the stairs. Below was a space lined with glossy coral-red armoires where, once again, only one or two pieces were artfully displayed. Astrid saw a beautiful cocktail dress with a silvery chainmail back and searched the garment for a tag indicating its size. "What size is this?" she asked the woman, standing watch like a pensive hawk. "It's couture, do you understand? Everything made to order," the woman replied drolly, waving her cigarette hand around and flicking ash everywhere. "So, how much would it cost for me to have this made in my size?" Astrid asked. The saleswoman made a quick assessment of Astrid. Asians hardly ever set foot in here. They usually kept to the famous designer boutiques on the Rue du Faubourg Saint-Honoré or the Avenue Montaigne, where they could inhale all the Chanel and Dior they wanted, God help them. Monsieur's collection was very avant-garde and only appreciated by the chicest Parisienne, New Yorkers, and a few Belgians. Clearly, the schoolgirl in the roll-neck fisherman's sweater, khakis, and espadrilles was out of her league.
Listen, chérie, everything here is très, très cher, and it takes 5 months for delivery. You really want to know how much it costs, she said, taking a slow drag from her cigarette.
Oh, I suppose not, Astrid said meekly. This lady obviously had no interest in helping her. She climbed the stairs and headed straight out the door, almost bumping into Charlie.
So quick. Didn't you like the clothes? Charlie queried.
I do, but the lady in there doesn't seem to want to sell me anything, so let's not waste our time, Astrid said.
Wait a minute. What do you mean she doesn't want to sell you anything?
Charlie tried to clarify.
Was she being snooty?
Uh-huh, Astrid reported.
We're going back in, Charlie said indignantly.
Charlie, let's just go to the next boutique on your list.
Astrid, sometimes I can't believe you're Harry Leong's daughter. Your father bought the most exclusive hotel in London when the manager was rude to your mother, for Christ's sakes. You need to learn how to stand up for yourself.
I know perfectly well how to stand up for myself, but it's simply not worth making a fuss over nothing, Astrid argued.
Well, it's not nothing to me. Nobody insults my girlfriend, Charlie declared, flinging the door wide open with gusto.
Astrid followed reluctantly, noticing that the red-headed saleslady was now joined by a man with platinum blonde hair. Charlie marched up and asked the man, in English,
Do you work here?
Oui, the man replied.
This is my girlfriend. I want to buy a whole new wardrobe for her. Will you help me?
The man crossed his arms lazily, slightly bemused by this scrawny teenager with a bad case of acne.
This is all haute couture, and the dresses start at 25,000 francs. There is also an 8-month wait, he said.
Not a problem, Charlie said boldly. You pay cash? How are you going to guarantee payment?
The lady asked in thickly accented English. Charlie sighed and whipped out his cell phone. He dialed a long series of numbers and waited for the other end to pick up.
Mr. Oi, it's Charlie Wu here. Sorry to disturb you at this time of night in Singapore. I'm in Paris at the moment. Tell me, Mr. Oi, does our bank have a relationship manager in Paris? Great. Will you call the fellow up and get him to make a call to this shop that I am at?
Charlie looked up and asked them for the name before continuing.
Tell him to inform these people that I am here with Astrid Leong.
Yes, Harry's daughter.
Yes,
and will you be sure your fellow lets them know I can afford to buy anything I damn well please? Thank you.
Astrid watched her boyfriend in silence. She had never seen him behave in such an assertive manner. Part of her felt like cringing from the vulgarity of his swagger, and part of her found it to be remarkably attractive. A few long minutes passed, and finally the phone rang. The redhead picked it up quickly, her eyes widening as she listened to the tirade coming from the other end.
Désolé, monsieur, très désolé, she kept saying into the phone.
She hung up and began a terse exchange with her male colleague, not realizing that Astrid could understand almost every word they were saying. The man leaped off the table and gazed at Charlie and Astrid with a sudden vigor.
Please, mademoiselle, let me show you the full collection, he said with a big smile.
The woman, meanwhile, smiled at Charlie.
Monsieur, would you like some champagne? Or a cappuccino, maybe?
I wonder what my banker told them,
Charlie whispered to Astrid as they were led downstairs into a cavernous dressing room.
Oh, that wasn't the banker, it was the designer himself. He told them he was rushing over to personally supervise my fittings.
Your banker must have called him directly, Astrid said.
Okay, I want you to order 10 dresses from this designer. We need to spend at least a few hundred thousand francs right now.
10? I don't think I even want 10 things from this place, Astrid said. Doesn't matter. You need to pick out 10 things. Actually, make that 20. As my father always says, the only way to get these Angmoh Gaosai to respect you is to smack them in the face with your Dua Lan Chiao money, your big cock money, until they get on their knees.
For the next 7 days, Charlie led Astrid on a shopping spree to end all shopping sprees.
He bought her a suite of luggage from Hermès, dozens of dresses from all the top designers that season, 16 pairs of shoes and 4 pairs of boots, a diamond-encrusted Patek Philippe watch that she never once wore, and a restored Art Nouveau lamp from Didier Aron. In between the marathon shopping, there were lunches at Mariage Frère and Ave, dinners at Le Grand Vifour and Les Ambassadeurs, and dancing the night away in their new finery at Le Palais and Le Queen. That week in Paris, Astrid not only discovered her taste for haute couture, she discovered a new passion. She had lived the first 18 years of her life surrounded by people who had money but claimed not to, people who preferred to hand things down rather than buy them new, people who simply didn't know how to enjoy their good fortune. Spending money the Charlie Wu way was absolutely exhilarating. Honestly, it was better than sex. Chapter 10. Tyersall Park, Singapore, 3:30 a.m. Rachel was quiet all the way home from the wedding ball. She graciously returned the sapphire necklace to Fiona in the foyer and bounded up the stairs. In the bedroom, she grabbed her suitcase from the built-in cupboard and began shoving in her clothes as fast as she could. She noticed that the laundry maids had placed thin sheets of scented blotting paper between each folded piece of clothing, and she began tearing them out frustratedly. She didn't want to take a single thing from this place. "What are you doing?" Nick said in bafflement as he entered the bedroom. "What does it look like? I'm getting out of here." "What? Why?" Nick frowned. "I've had enough of this shit. I refuse to be a sitting duck for all these crazy women in your life." "What on earth are you talking about, Rachel?" Nick stared at her in confusion. He had never seen her this angry before. "I'm talking about Mandy and Francesca, and God only knows who else," Rachel cried, continuing to grab her things from the armoire. "I don't know what you've heard, Rachel, but oh, so you deny it? You deny that you had a threesome with them?" Nick's eyes flared in shock. For a moment, he wasn't sure what to say. "I don't deny it, but you asshole." Nick threw his hands up in despair. "Rachel, I'm 32, and as far as I know, I've never mentioned joining the priesthood. I do have a sexual history, but I've never tried to conceal any of it from you." "It's not that you concealed it. It's more that you never told me in the first place. You should have said something. You should have told me that Francesca and you had a past so I didn't have to sit there tonight and get totally blindsided. I felt like a total fucking idiot." Nick sat down on the edge of the chaise lounge, burying his face in his hands. Rachel had every right to be angry. It just never occurred to him to mention something that happened half a lifetime ago. "I'm so sorry," he began. "A threesome? With Mandy and Francesca? Really? Of all the women in the world," Rachel said contemptuously as she struggled with the zipper on her suitcase. Nick sighed deeply. He wanted to explain that Francesca had been a very different girl back then, before her grandfather's stroke and all that money. But he realized that this was not the time to defend her. He approached Rachel slowly and put his arms around her. She tried to break away from him, but he locked his arms around her tightly. "Look at me, Rachel. Look at me," he said calmly. "Francesca and I just had a brief fling that summer in Capri. That's all it was. We were stupid 16-year-olds, all raging hormones. That was almost 2 decades ago. I was single for 4 years before I met you, and I think you know precisely how the last 2 years have gone. You are the center of my life, Rachel. The absolute center. What happened tonight? Who told you all these things?" With that, Rachel broke down and it all came flooding out. Everything that happened at Araminta's bachelorette weekend, all of Mandy's constant innuendos, the stunt that Francesca had pulled at the wedding ball. Nick listened to Rachel's ordeal, feeling sick to his stomach the more he heard. Here he thought she had been having the time of her life. It pained him to see how shaken up she was, to see the tears spill down her pretty face. "Rachel, I am so sorry. I can't even begin to tell you how sorry I am," Nick said earnestly. Rachel stood facing the window, wiping the tears from her eyes. She was angry at herself for crying and confused by the tidal wave of emotion that had swept over her, but she just couldn't help it. The shock of the evening and the pent-up stress of the days leading up to it had brought her to this point, and now she was drained. I wish you had told me about the bachelorette weekend, Rachel. If I had known, I could have done more to protect you. I really had no clue those girls could be so vicious, Nick said, searching for the right word in his fury. I'll make sure you never see them again. Just please, don't leave like this, especially when we haven't even had a chance to enjoy a holiday together. Let me make it up to you, Rachel, please. Rachel kept silent. She stayed facing the window, suddenly noticing a strange set of shadows moving on the darkened expanse of lawn. A moment later, she realized it was just a uniformed Gurkha on his night patrol with a pair of Dobermans. I don't think you get it, Nick. I'm still mad at you. You didn't prepare me for any of this. I traveled halfway around the world with you, and you told me nothing before we left. What should I have told you? Nick asked, genuinely perplexed. All this, Rachel cried, waving her hands around at the opulent bedroom they were standing in. The fact that there's an army of Gurkhas with dogs protecting your grandmother while she sleeps, the fact that you grew up in friggin' Downton Abbey, the fact that your best friend was throwing the most expensive wedding in the history of civilization. You should have told me about your family, about your friends, about your life here, so I could at least know what I was getting myself into. Nick sank onto the chaise lounge, sighing wearily. Astrid did try to warn me to prepare you, but I was so sure that you'd feel right at home when you got here. I mean, I've seen how you are in different settings, the way you're able to charm the socks off everyone, your students, the chancellor, and all the university bigwigs, even that grouchy Japanese sandwich guy on 13th Street. And I guess I just didn't know what to say. How could I have explained all this to you without your being here to see it yourself? Well, I came and saw for myself, and now I feel like I don't know who my boyfriend is anymore, Rachel said forlornly. Nick stared at Rachel, open-mouthed, stung by her remark. Have I really changed that much in the past couple of weeks? Because I feel like I'm the same person, and how I feel about you certainly hasn't changed. If anything, I love you more every day, and even more at this moment. Oh, Nick, Rachel sighed, sitting down on the edge of the bed. I don't know how to explain it. It's true. You have stayed exactly the same, but the world around you, this world around us, is so different from anything I'm used to. And I'm trying to figure out how I could possibly fit into this world. But don't you see how well you do fit in? You must realize that aside from a few inconsequential girls, everyone adores you. My best friends all think you're the bee's knees. You should have heard the way Colin and Mehmet were raving about you last night. And my parents like you. My whole family likes you. Rachel shot him a look, and Nick could see that she wasn't buying it. He sat down next to her and noticed that her shoulders tightened almost imperceptibly. He longed to run a hand up and down her back soothingly, like he did almost every night in bed, but he knew better than to touch her now. What could he do to reassure her at this moment? Rachel, I never meant for you to get hurt. You know I'll do anything to make you happy, he said in a quiet voice. I know, Rachel said after a pause. As upset as she was, she couldn't stay mad at Nick for long. He had mishandled things, for sure, but she knew he wasn't to blame for Francesca's bitchiness. This was exactly what Francesca had been hoping to achieve, to make her doubt herself, to make her angry at Nick. Rachel sighed, leaning her head on his shoulder. A sudden gleam came over Nick's eyes. I have an idea. Why don't we go away tomorrow? Let's skip the tea ceremony at the Coos. I don't think you really want to stand around and watch Araminta get piled with tons of jewelry from all her relatives anyway. Let's get out of Singapore and clear our heads. I know a special place we can go. Rachel eyed him warily. Is it going to involve more private jets and 6-star resorts? Nick shook his head rapidly. Don't worry. We're driving. I'm taking you to Malaysia. I'm taking you to a remote lodge in the Cameron Highlands, far away from all this. Chapter 11. Residences at 1 Cairnhill, Singapore. Eleanor was just sitting down to her usual breakfast of toasted 7-grain bread, low-fat butter, and low-sugar marmalade when the phone rang. Whenever the phone rang this early in the morning, she knew it had to be one of her siblings in America. This was probably her brother in Seattle begging for another loan.
When Consuelo entered the breakfast room with the phone, Eleanor shook her head and mouthed silently,
Tell him I'm still asleep.
No, no, ma'am. Not yet, oh brother. It's Mrs. Fu.
Oh, Eleanor said, grabbing the phone as she took a bite of her toast.
Daisy, what are you doing up so early? Did you have indigestion too after that awful wedding banquet?
No, no, El, I have breaking news,
Daisy said excitedly.
What? What?
Eleanor asked in anticipation. She said a quick prayer and hoped Daisy was going to report on the tragic breakup of Nikki and Rachel. Francesca had winked at her during the fireworks last night and whispered two words, It's done. And Eleanor noticed during the ferry ride home that Rachel looked like she had been hit in the face with a durian.
Guess who just woke up from a coma?
Daisy announced.
Oh, who?
Eleanor asked, a little crestfallen.
Just guess, la. I don't know. That Von Bulow woman?
Aya, no, la. Sir Ronald Shaw woke up. Nate Dean's father-in-law.
A la mac.
Eleanor almost spat out her toast.
I thought he was a living vegetable.
Well, somehow the vegetable woke up and he's even talking. The cousin of my maid's daughter-in-law is the night nurse at Mount E, and apparently she got the shock of her life when patient Shaw woke up at 4 this morning and started demanding his copio.
How long has he been in a coma?
Eleanor asked, looking up and noticing Nick stroll into the kitchen.
Oh my, Nick was over bright and early. Something must have happened.
6 years now. Nadine, Ronnie, Francesca, the whole family have rushed to his bedside, and the news crews are just arriving.
Huh. Do you think we should go down too?
Eleanor asked.
I think let's wait. Let's see. You know, I hear that sometimes these coma victims wake up right before they die.
If he's asking for copio, that dreadful black coffee, something tells me he's not going to kick the bucket anytime soon, Eleanor surmised. She said goodbye to Daisy and focused her attention on Nick.
Francesca's grandfather woke up from his coma this morning, Eleanor relayed, buttering another piece of toast.
I didn't even realize he was still alive, Nick said disinterestedly.
What are you doing here so early? Do you want some breakfast? Some kaya toast?
No, no, I already ate.
Where's Rachel this morning?
Eleanor asked a little too eagerly.
Was the girl tossed out in the middle of the night like garbage?
Rachel's still asleep. I got up early to talk to you and Dad.
Is he up yet?
A la Mark. Your father sleeps till 10, at the earliest.
Well, then I'll tell you first. I'm going away with Rachel for a few days, and if all goes according to plan, I intend to propose to her while we're away,
Nick declared. Eleanor put down her toast and gave him a look of unconcealed horror.
Nicky, you can't be serious.
I'm totally serious, Nick said, taking a seat at the table.
I know you don't know her very well yet, but that's been my fault entirely. I haven't given you or Dad the chance to meet her until now. But I can assure you that you'll soon discover what an amazing human being she is. She's going to be a fantastic daughter-in-law to you, Mum.
Why are you rushing into this?
I'm not rushing into anything. We've dated for nearly 2 years. We've practically been living together for the past year. I was planning to propose on our 2-year anniversary this October, but some stuff happened, and I need to show Rachel how important she is to me right now.
What stuff?
Nick sighed. It's a long story, but Rachel's been treated badly by a few people since arriving, Francesca especially.
What did Francesca do?
Eleanor asked innocently.
It doesn't matter what she did. What matters is that I have to put things right.
Eleanor's mind raced in circles.
What the hell happened last night? That stupid Francesca. A la muck. Her plan must have backfired.
You don't have to marry her just to put things right, Nikki. Don't let this girl pressure you.
Eleanor urged.
I'm not being pressured. The truth is, I have been thinking about marrying Rachel almost since the day I met her. And now, more than ever, I know she is the one for me.
She is so smart, Mum, and such a good person.
Eleanor was seething inside, but she tried to speak in a measured voice.
I'm sure Rachel is a nice girl, but she can never be your wife.
And why is that?
Nick leaned back in his chair, amused by the absurdity of his mother's words.
She is just not suitable for you, Nicky. She does not come from the right background.
Nobody is ever going to come from the right background in your eyes, Nick scoffed.
I'm only telling you what everyone is already thinking, Nick. You haven't heard the horrible things I've heard. Do you know her family comes from mainland China?
Stop it, Mum. I'm so fed up with this ridiculous snobbery you and your friends have toward the mainland Chinese. We are all Chinese. Just because some people actually work for the money doesn't mean they are beneath you.
Eleanor shook her head and continued in a graver tone.
Nikki, you don't understand. She will never be accepted. And I'm not talking about your dad and me. I'm talking about your dear Ama and the rest of the family. Take it from me. Even though I have been married to your father for 34 years, I am still considered an outsider. I am a Sung. I came from a respectable family, a rich family, but in their eyes, I was never good enough. Do you want to see Rachel suffer like that? Look at how they have frozen out that Kitty Pong girl. How can you even compare Rachel to Kitty? Rachel isn't a soap opera star who runs around in skimpy clothes. She's an economist with a PhD, and everyone in the family has been perfectly nice to her. It is one thing to be polite to your guest, but I can assure you that if they really thought she had any chance of being your wife, they would not be so nice.
That's nonsense. No, Nikki, that is a fact, Eleanor snapped. Ama will never allow you to marry Rachel, no matter how accomplished she is.
Come on, Nikki, you know this. It's been told to you 1,000 times since you were a little boy. You are a young...
Nick shook his head and laughed. This is all so unbelievably archaic. We're living in the 21st century, and Singapore is one of the most progressive countries on the planet. I can assure you, Ama doesn't feel the way she did 30 years ago.
A la Mark, I've known your grandmother a lot longer than you have. You don't know how important bloodlines are to her.
Nick rolled his eyes. To her or to you? I haven't researched Rachel's genealogy, but if necessary, I'm sure I can find some dead Ming emperor somewhere in her bloodline. Besides, she comes from a very respectable family. One of her cousins is even a famous film director.
Nikki, there are things about Rachel's family that you don't realize.
And how would you know this? Did Cassandra invent some story about Rachel's family or something?
Eleanor kept silent on that score. She simply warned, Save yourself and Rachel the heartache, Nikki. You have to give her up now before things go any further.
She's not something I can just give up, Mum. I love her, and I'm going to marry her.
I don't need anyone's approval, Nick said forcefully, rising from the table. Stupid boy, Ama will disinherit you.
Like I care.
Nikki, listen to me. I haven't sacrificed my whole life for you just to see you waste everything on that girl, Eleanor said anxiously. Sacrificed your whole life? I'm not sure what you mean when you're sitting here at the chef's table of your $20 million apartment, Nick huffed. You have no idea. If you marry Rachel, you will be ruining all our lives. Make her your mistress if you need to, but for heaven's sake, don't throw away your entire future by marrying her, Eleanor pleaded.
Nick snorted in disgust and stood up, kicking away the chair behind him as he stormed out of the breakfast alcove. Eleanor winced as the chrome chair legs cut across the Calicutta marble floor. She stared at the perfectly aligned rows of Astier de Vilat porcelain that lined the exposed stainless steel shelves of her kitchen, reflecting on the heated exchange she had just endured. Every effort she had made to prevent her son from careening into this disastrous situation had failed, and now there was but one option left. Eleanor sat absolutely still for a few long moments, summoning the courage for the conversation she had been trying to avoid for so long.
Consuelo, she shouted. Tell Ahmad to get the car ready. I need to go to Tyersall Park in 15 minutes.
Chapter 12. Weathering Towers, Hong Kong. Astrid awoke to a shaft of sunlight on her face. What time was it? She looked at the clock on the side table and noticed it was after 10. She stretched into a yawn, crawled out of bed, and went to splash some water on her face. When she padded into the living room, she saw Charlie's elderly Chinese nanny sitting on one of the chrome and calfskin Le Corbusier lounge chairs, frantically focused on a game on her iPad. Achi pressed the screen furiously, muttering in Cantonese,
Cursed beds!
When she noticed Astrid passing by, she broke into a toothy grin.
Hiya, Astrid! Did you sleep well? There's breakfast waiting for you, she said, her eyes never leaving the glowing screen. A young maid rushed up to Astrid and said, Ma'am, please, breakfast? Gesturing toward the dining room. There, she found a rather excessive spread laid out for her on the round glass table. Pitchers of coffee, tea, and orange juice were accompanied by poached eggs and thick-cut bacon on a warming plate, scrambled eggs with Cumberland sausages, toasted English muffins, French toast, sliced mango with Greek yogurt, three types of breakfast cereals, silver dollar pancakes with strawberries and chantilly cream, fried crullers with fish congee. Another maid stood at attention behind Astrid, waiting to pounce forward and serve. Achi came into the dining room and said,
We didn't know what you would want for breakfast, so the cook made a few options. Eat, eat. And then the car is waiting to take you to Charlie Boy's office down the hill.
Astrid grabbed the bowl of yogurt and said, This is all I need, much to Achi's dismay. She went back to the bedroom and put on an ink-blue Rick Owens top over a pair of white jeans. After brushing her hair quickly, she decided to wear it in a low ponytail, something she never did. And rummaging through Charlie's bathroom drawers, she found a pair of Cutler & Gross horn sunglasses that fit her. This was as incognito as she was going to get. As she left the bedroom, one of the maids sprinted to the entrance foyer and summoned the elevator, while another held it open until Astrid was ready to enter. Astrid was mildly amused by how even an act as simple as exiting the flat was handled with such military urgency by these skittish girls. It was so different from the gracious, easygoing servants she had grown up with. In the lobby, a chauffeur in a crisp black uniform with gold buttons bowed at Astrid.
Where's Mr. Wu's office? Astrid asked.
Wuthering Towers, on Chater Road. He gestured toward the forest-green Bentley parked outside, but Astrid said,
Thanks, but I think I'll walk, remembering the building well.
It was the same place Charlie always had to go to pick up envelopes stuffed with cash from his father's secretary whenever they came to Hong Kong on weekend shopping binges. Before the chauffeur could protest, Astrid walked across the plaza to the mid-levels escalator, strolling purposefully along the moving platform as it snaked its way down the hilly urban terrain. At the base of the escalator on Queen Street, Astrid took a deep breath and plunged into the fast-moving river of pedestrians. There was something about Hong Kong's central district during the day, a special frenetic energy from the hustling and bustling crowd that always gave Astrid an intoxicating rush. Bankers in smart pinstripes walked shoulder to shoulder with dusty day laborers and teenagers in school uniforms, while chicly outfitted corporate women in don't-mess-with-me heels melded seamlessly with wizened old amas and half-clothed street beggars. Astrid turned left onto Petter Street and entered the landmark shopping mall. The first thing she saw was a long line of people. What was happening? Oh, it was just the usual queue of mainland Chinese shoppers outside the Gucci store, anxiously awaiting their turn to go inside and get their fix. Astrid expertly negotiated her way through the network of pedestrian bridges and passageways that connected the landmark to neighboring buildings, up the escalator to the mezzanine level of the Mandarin Oriental, through the shopping arcade at Alexandra House, down the short flight of steps by Cova Cafe, and here she was in the gleaming lobby of Wuthering Towers. The reception counter appeared to have been sculpted from one massive block of malachite, and as Astrid approached, a man with an earpiece in a dark suit intercepted her and said discreetly,
Mrs. Tio, I'm with Mr. Wu. Please come with me.
He waved her through the security checkpoint and into an express elevator that zipped straight up to the 55th floor. The elevator doors opened onto a serene, windowless room with alabaster white walls inlaid with hairline circular patterns and a silvery blue sofa. The man ushered Astrid wordlessly past the three executive secretaries who sat at adjoining tables and through a pair of imposing etched bronze doors. Astrid found herself in Charlie's atrium-like office, which had a soaring, pyramid-shaped glass ceiling and a bank of flat-screen televisions along one entire wall
that silently flickered financial news channels from New York, London, Shanghai, and Dubai. A very tan Chinese man in a black suit and wire-framed glasses was seated on a nearby sofa.
"You almost gave my driver a panic attack," Charlie said, getting up from his desk.
Astrid smiled. "You need to cut your staff some slack, Charlie. They live in complete terror of you."
"Actually, they live in complete terror of my wife," Charlie responded with a grin.
He gestured to the man seated on the black sofa.
"This is Mr. Lui, who has already managed to find your husband by using the cell number you gave me last night."
Mr. Lui nodded at Astrid and began speaking in that distinctive, clipped, British-accented English that was so common in Hong Kong.
"Every iPhone has a GPS locator, which makes it possible for us to track the owner very easily," Mr. Lui explained. "Your husband has been at an apartment in Mong Kok since last night."
Mr. Lui presented Astrid with his thin laptop computer, where a sequence of images awaited. Michael exiting the flat, Michael exiting the elevator, Michael clutching a bundle of plastic bags on the street. The last picture, taken from a high angle, showed a woman opening the door of the flat to let Michael in. Astrid's stomach tightened into a knot. Who was the other woman? She scrutinized the picture for a long while, staring at the barefooted woman, dressed in denim shorts and a skimpy tank top.
"Can we enlarge the picture?" Astrid asked.
As Mr. Lui zoomed in on the blurry, pixelated face, Astrid suddenly sat back on the sofa.
"There's something very familiar about that woman," she said, her pulse quickening.
"Who is she?" Charlie asked.
"I'm not sure, but I know I've seen her somewhere before," Astrid said, closing her eyes and pressing her fingers to her forehead.
Then it hit her. Her throat seemed to close up, and she couldn't speak.
"Are you okay?" Charlie asked, seeing the look on Astrid's face.
"I'm okay, I think. I believe this girl was at my wedding. I think there's a picture of her in a group photo from one of my albums."
"Your wedding?" Charlie said in shock.
Turning to Mr. Lui, he demanded, "What do you have on her?"
"Nothing on her yet. The flat's registered owner is Mr. Thomas Ying," the private investigator replied.
"Doesn't ring any bells," Astrid said numbly.
"We're still assembling a dossier," Mr. Lui said.
An instant message flashed on his phone, and he reported,
"The woman just left the flat with a young boy, approximately 4 years old."
Astrid's heart sank.
"Have you been able to find out anything about the boy?"
"We have not. We did not know there was a boy inside the flat with them until this moment."
"So the woman has left with the boy, and my husband is alone now?"
"Yes. We don't think anyone else is in the apartment."
"You don't think? Can you be sure there isn't someone else in there? Can't you use some sort of thermal sensor?"
Charlie asked. Mr. Lui gave a little snort.
"Hiya, this isn't the CIA. Of course, we can always escalate and bring in specialists if you wish, but for domestics such as these, we don't usually..."
"I want to see my husband," Astrid said matter-of-factly. "Can you take me to him now?"
"Miss Tio, in these situations, we really don't advise," the man delicately began.
"I don't care. I need to see him face to face," Astrid insisted. A few minutes later, Astrid sat quietly in the back of the Mercedes with tinted windows, while Mr. Lui rode in the front passenger seat, frantically barking orders in Cantonese to the team assembled around 64 Pak Tin Street. Charlie wanted to come along, but Astrid had insisted on going alone.
"Don't worry, Charlie. Nothing's going to happen. I'm just going to have a talk with Michael."
Now her mind was reeling, and she was getting more and more antsy as the car inched through lunchtime traffic in Tsim Sha Tsui. She just didn't know what to think anymore. Who exactly was this girl? It looked like the affair must have been going on since before their wedding, but then why had Michael married her? It clearly wasn't for money. Her husband had always been so rabidly insistent about not wanting to benefit from her family's wealth. He had readily signed the 150-page prenuptial agreement without so much as a blink, as well as the postnuptial her family's lawyers had insisted on after Cassian was born. Her money and Cassian's money was more secure than the Bank of China's. So what was it that motivated Michael to have a wife in Singapore and a mistress in Hong Kong? Astrid looked out her car window and noticed a Rolls-Royce Phantom next to her.
Enthroned in the back seat was a couple, probably in their early 30s, dressed to the nines. The woman had short, smartly coiffed hair and was immaculately made up and dressed in a purple blouse with an enormous diamond and emerald floral brooch pinned to her right shoulder. The man at her side was sporting a florid Versace silk bomber jacket and Latin dictator-style dark sunglasses. Anywhere else in the world, this couple would have looked completely absurd. They were at least 3 decades too young to be chauffeured around so ostentatiously. But this was Hong Kong, and somehow it worked here. Astrid wondered where they came from and where they were going. Probably off to lunch at the club. What secrets did they keep from each other? Did the husband have a mistress? Did the wife have a lover? Were there any children? Were they happy? The woman sat perfectly still, staring dead ahead, while the man slouched slightly away from her, reading the business section of the South China Morning Post. The traffic began to move again, and suddenly they were in Mong Kok, with its dense, hulking 60s apartment blocks crowding out the sunlight. Before she knew it, Astrid was being led out of the car, flanked by 4 security men in dark suits. She looked around nervously as they escorted her to an old block of flats and into a small fluorescent-lit elevator with avocado green walls. On the 10th floor, they emerged into an open-air hallway that skirted along an inner courtyard where lines of laundry hung from every available window. They walked past apartments with plastic slippers and shoes by the doorways, and soon they were in front of the metal grille door of flat 1007B. The tallest man rang the doorbell once, and a moment later, Astrid could hear a few latches being undone. The door opened, and there he was, her husband, standing right in front of her. Michael glanced at the security detail surrounding Astrid and shook his head in disgust. "Let me guess. Your father hired these goons to track me down."
Chapter 13. Cameron Highlands, Malaysia. Nick borrowed his father's 1963 Jaguar E-Type Roadster from the garage at Tyersall Park, and he and Rachel headed onto the Pan Island Expressway, bound for the bridge that links Singapore to the Malay Peninsula. From Johor Bahru, they drove up the Utara Selatan Highway, detouring to the seaside town of Melaka so that Nick could show Rachel the distinctive crimson-hued facade of Christchurch, built by the Dutch when the town was part of their colonial empire, and the charmingly ornate Peranakan row houses along Jalan Tun Tan Cheng Lock. Afterward, they stayed on the old road that skirted along the Negeri Sembilan coast for a while. With the top down and the warm ocean breeze on her face, Rachel began to feel more relaxed than she had since arriving in Asia. The trauma of the past few days was dissipating, and at last it felt like they were truly on holiday together. She loved the wildness of these back roads, the rustic seaside hamlets that seemed untouched by time, the way Nick looked with day-old stubble and the wind whipping through his hair. A few miles north of Port Dickson, Nick turned down a dirt road thick with tropical vegetation, and as Rachel looked inland, she could glimpse miles and miles of uniformly planted trees. "What are those perfect rows of trees?" Rachel asked.
"Rubber. We're surrounded by rubber plantations," Nick explained.
They pulled up to a spot right by the beach, got out of the car, took off their sandals, and strolled onto the hot sand. A few Malay families were scattered about the beach having lunch, the ladies' colorful headscarves flapping in the wind as they bustled around canteens of food and children who were more interested in frolicking in the surf. It was a cloudy day, and the sea was a mottled tapestry of deep green with patches of azure where the clouds broke. A Malay woman and her son came toward them, hauling a big blue and white styrofoam cooler. Nick began talking animatedly with the woman, buying 2 bundles from her igloo before bending down and asking the boy a question. The boy nodded eagerly and ran off, while Nick found a shady spot underneath the low-hanging branches of a mangrove tree. He handed Rachel a still-warm banana leaf packet tied with string.
"Try Malaysia's most popular dish, nasi lemak," he said.
Rachel undid the string, and the glossy banana leaf unfolded to reveal a neatly composed mound of rice surrounded by sliced cucumbers, tiny fried anchovies, roasted peanuts, and a hard-boiled egg.
"Pass me a fork," Rachel said. "There's no fork. You get to go native on this. Use your fingers."
Nick grinned.
"You're kidding, right?"
"Nope, that's the traditional way.
Malays believe the food actually tastes better when you eat with your hands. They only use the right hand to eat, of course. The left hand is used for purposes better left unmentioned.
But I haven't washed my hands, Nick. Don't think I can eat like this, Rachel said, sounding a little alarmed.
Come on, Miss OCD, tough it out, Nick teased. He scooped some of the rice into his fingers and began eating the nasi lemak with gusto. Rachel gingerly scooped some of the rice into her mouth, instantly breaking into a smile.
Mmm, it's coconut rice.
Yes, but you haven't even gotten to the good part yet. Dig a little deeper.
Rachel dug into her rice and discovered a curry sauce oozing out from the middle along with big chunks of chicken.
Oh my God, she said. Does it taste this good because of all the different flavors or because we're sitting on this gorgeous beach eating it?
Oh, I think it's your hands. Your grotty hands are giving the food all the added flavor, Nick said.
I'm about to slap you with my grotty curry hands, Rachel scowled at him.
Just as she was finishing her last bite, the little boy from earlier ran up with two clear plastic drinking bags filled with rough chunks of ice and freshly squeezed sugarcane juice. Nick took the drinks from the boy and handed him a $10 bill.
Kamu anak yang baik, he said, patting the boy on the shoulder.
The boy's eyes widened in delight. He tucked the money into the elastic band of his soccer shorts and scrambled off to tell his mother about his windfall.
What did you say to the kid? Rachel asked.
Oh, I just told him what a good boy he was.
You never cease to amaze me, Nicholas Young.
Why didn't I know you spoke Malay? Rachel said.
Only a few rudimentary words, enough to order food, Nick replied modestly.
That conversation you had earlier didn't sound rudimentary to me, Rachel countered, sipping the icy sweet sugarcane through a thin pink straw tucked into the corner of the plastic bag.
Trust me, I'm sure that lady was cringing at my grandma. Nick shrugged.
You're doing it again, Nick, Rachel said.
Doing what?
You're doing that annoying self-deprecating thing.
I'm not sure I know what you mean.
Rachel sighed in exasperation.
You say you don't speak Malay when I hear you yapping away. You say, oh, this old house, when we're in a friggin' palace. You downplay everything, Nick.
I don't even realize when I'm doing it, Nick said.
Why? I mean, you downplay things to the point that your parents don't even have a clue how well you're doing in New York.
It's just the way I was brought up, I guess.
Do you think it's because your family is so wealthy and you had to overcompensate by being super modest? Rachel suggested.
I wouldn't put it quite like that. I was just trained to speak precisely and never to be boastful.
Also, we're not that wealthy.
Well then, what are you exactly? Are you guys worth hundreds of millions or billions?
Nick's face began to redden, but Rachel wouldn't let up.
I know it makes you uncomfortable, Nick, but that's why I'm prodding you.
You're telling me one thing, but then I hear other people speaking as if the entire economy of Asia revolves around your family, and you're like the heir to the throne. I'm an economist for crying out loud, and if I'm going to be accused of being a gold digger, I'd like to know what I'm supposedly digging for, Rachel said bluntly.
Nick fidgeted with the remnant of his banana leaf nervously. Since he was old enough to remember, it had been ingrained into him that any talk of the family wealth was off limits. But it was only fair that Rachel know what she was getting herself into, especially if he was, very shortly, going to ask her to accept the canary diamond ring hidden in the lower right pocket of his cargo shorts.
I know this may sound silly, but the truth is, I really don't know how rich my family is, Nick began tentatively. Now, my parents live very well, mostly due to the legacy my mom received from her parents, and I have a private income that's not too shabby, mainly from stocks left to me by my grandfather. But we don't have the kind of money that Collins or Astrid's family does, not even close.
But how about your grandmother? I mean, Paik Lin says that Tyersall Park must be worth hundreds of millions just for the land alone, Rachel interjected.
My grandmother has always lived in the manner that she has, so I can only presume that her holdings are substantial. 3 times a year, Mr. Tay, an elderly gentleman from the family bank, comes up to Tyersall Park in the same brown Peugeot he's driven ever since I was born and pays a visit to my grandmother. She meets with him alone, and it's the only time her lady's maids have to leave the room. So it's never crossed my mind to ask her how much she's worth.
And your father never talked to you about it?
My father has never once brought up the subject of money. He probably knows even less than I do. You know, when there's always been money in your life, it's not something you spend much time thinking about.
Rachel tried to wrap her mind around that concept.
So why does everyone think you'll end up inheriting everything? Nick bristled. This is Singapore, and the idle rich spend all their time gossiping about other people's money. Who's worth how much, who inherited how much, who sold their house for how much. But everything that's said about my family is pure speculation. The point is, I've never presumed that I will one day be the sole inheritor of some great fortune. But you must have known that you were different, Rachel said. Well, I sensed that I was different because I lived in this big old house with all these rituals and traditions, but I never thought it had anything to do with money. When you're a kid, you're more concerned with how many pineapple tarts you're allowed to eat or where to catch the best tadpoles. I didn't grow up with a sense of entitlement like some of my cousins did. At least I hope not. I wouldn't have been attracted to you if you went around acting like some pompous prick, Rachel said. As they walked back to the car, she slipped her arm around his waist. Thank you for opening up. I know it wasn't easy for you to talk about these things.
I want you to know everything about me, Rachel. I always have, which is why I invited you here in the first place. I'm sorry if it has felt like I wasn't forthcoming. I just didn't think any of this money talk was relevant. I mean, in New York, none of this really matters to our life, does it?
Rachel paused for a while before answering. It doesn't, especially now that I have a better understanding of your family. I just needed to be sure that you're the same person I fell in love with back in New York, that's all.
Am I?
You're way cuter now that I know you're loaded. Nick laughed and pulled Rachel tightly into his arms, giving her a long, lingering kiss.
Ready for a complete change of scenery?
He asked, kissing her chin and then moving down to the tender spot in her throat.
I think I'm ready to get a room.
Any motels close by? Rachel breathed, her fingers still entangled in his hair, not wanting him to stop.
I don't think there are any motels you'd want to be in. Let's race to Cameron Highlands before it gets dark. It's only about 3 hours away, and then we can pick up where we left off on the most ginormous four-poster bed you've ever seen.
They made good time on the E1 highway, passing through the capital city of Kuala Lumpur toward Ipoh. When they reached the town of Tapa, the gateway to the Cameron Highlands, Nick turned onto the picturesque old road and they began the ascent up the mountain. The car climbed the steep hill, with Nick expertly negotiating the twists and turns, honking the horn at every blind curve. Nick was anxious to get to the house before sunset. He had called ahead and given explicit instructions to Raja, the majordomo. There were going to be votive candles in white paper bags lining the way down to the lookout point at the end of the lawn, and a stand with chilled champagne and fresh mangosteens right next to the carved wooden bench where they could sit and take in the scenic view. Then, just as the sun was sinking behind the hills and thousands of tropical birds descended into the treetops, he would get down on one knee and ask Rachel to be his forever. He wondered which was the correct knee to get down on, right or left. Rachel, meanwhile, found herself clutching at her seatbelt buckle tightly as she gazed out the window at sheer drops down into jungle-like ravines.
I'm in no hurry to die, she announced anxiously.
I'm only going 40 miles per hour. Don't worry, I can drive this road blindfolded. I used to come here almost every weekend during the summer holidays. Plus, don't you think it would be a glamorous way to die, careening down the side of a mountain in a classic Jag convertible?
Nick cracked, trying to diffuse the tension. If it's all right with you, I'd rather live a few days longer. And I'd rather be in an old Ferrari, like James Dean, Rachel quipped.
Actually, it was a Porsche. Smartass.
The hairpin curve soon gave way to a breathtaking view of undulating green hills, punctuated by bright swaths of color. In the distance, Rachel could make out flower orchards tucked along the hillsides and quaint little cottages.
This is Burton Valley, Nick said with a flourish. We're about 1,200 meters above sea level now. Back in the colonial days, this was where British officers would come to escape the tropical heat.
Just past the town of Tana Rata, they turned onto a narrow private road that snaked its way up a lushly planted hill. Behind another curve, a stately Tudor-style manor house on its own hillock suddenly reared into view.
I thought you promised you weren't going to take me to some luxury hotel, Rachel said in a half-chiding tone. This isn't a hotel, this is my grandmother's summer lodge.
Why am I not surprised, Rachel said, gazing at the beautiful structure. The lodge wasn't nearly as big as Tyersall Park, but it still looked formidably grand with its gabled roofs and black-and-white timbered woodwork. The whole place was aglow with lights blazing from the casement windows.
Looks like we've been expected, Rachel said.
Well, I called ahead for them to prepare for our arrival. There's a full staff all year round, Nick replied. The house was situated halfway up a gentle slope with a long paved stone path leading up to the front door. Its facade was partially covered in ivy and wisteria, and lining both sides of the slope were rose bushes that grew almost up to eye level. Rachel sighed, thinking she had never seen such a romantic mountain haven in her life. What enormous roses! These are special Cameronian roses that only grow in this climate. Isn't the scent intoxicating? Nick chatted on nervously. He knew he was only minutes away from one of the seminal moments of his life. A young Malay butler wearing a crisp white dress shirt tucked into a gray patterned sarong opened the door, bowing gallantly at them. Nick wondered where Raja, the longtime butler, was. Rachel stepped into the front foyer and felt as if she had been transported once again into another era, to the colonial Malaya of a Somerset Maugham novel, perhaps. Anglo-Raj wooden benches in the front hall were interspersed with wicker baskets brimming with freshly picked camellias, mica shade lanterns hung from the mahogany-paneled walls, and a long, faded Tianjin silk carpet drew the eye straight back to the French doors and the glorious view of the highlands.
Before I show you the rest of the house, let's, take in the sunset view, Nick said, feeling his throat go dry with anticipation.
He led Rachel across the foyer and reached for the handle of the French doors leading out onto the terrace. Then suddenly he halted. He blinked a few times just to make sure he wasn't hallucinating. Standing at the edge of the expansive formal lawn, having a smoke, was Ahmad, his mother's chauffeur.
Fuck me, Nick swore under his breath.
What? What's wrong? Rachel asked.
I think we've got company, Nick muttered darkly.
He turned around, heading for the drawing room, down the hall. Peering in, his suspicions were confirmed. Sure enough, perched on the floral chintz settee, facing the door, was his mother, who shot him a rather triumphant look as he entered the room. He was about to say something when his mother announced, a little too cheerily,
"Oh, look, Mummy, Nick and Rachel have arrived."
Rachel spun around. Sitting in the armchair in front of the fireplace was Nick's grandmother, swaddled in an embroidered cashmere shawl, being poured a cup of tea by one of her Thai lady's maids.
"Amma, what are you doing here?" Nick asked in astonishment.
"I received some very disturbing news, and so we rushed up here," Suyi said in Mandarin, speaking slowly and deliberately.
Nick always found it disconcerting when his grandmother spoke to him in Mandarin. He associated that particular dialect with childhood scoldings.
"What news? What has happened?" Nick asked, getting concerned.
"Well, I heard that you ran off to Malaysia, and that you mean to ask the girl to marry you," Suyi said, not bothering to look at Rachel.
Rachel pursed her lips, shocked and thrilled at the same time.
"I was planning to surprise Rachel, but I guess that's ruined now," Nick huffed, staring at his mother.
"No matter, Nicky," his grandmother smiled. "I do not give you permission to marry her. Now, let's stop all this nonsense and go home. I don't want to be stuck having dinner here when the cook hasn't prepared properly for me. I'm sure she didn't get any fresh fish today."
Rachel's jaw dropped.
"Amma, I'm sorry I don't have your blessing, but that doesn't change a thing. I intend to marry Rachel if she'll have me,"
Nick said calmly, glancing at Rachel hopefully.
"Don't talk nonsense. This girl does not come from a proper family," Suyi said.
Rachel felt her face go hot. "I've heard enough of this," she said in a quivering voice, turning to leave the room.
"No, Rachel, please don't go,"
Nick said, grabbing her by the arm.
"I need you to hear this.
Amma, I don't know what stories you've been told, but I have met Rachel's family, and I like them very much. They have certainly shown me a great deal more courtesy, warmth, and respect than our family has shown to Rachel. Of course they should respect you. After all, you're a young," Suyi said.
"I can't believe you just said that," Nick groaned.
Eleanor stood up and approached Rachel, looking her in the eye.
"Rachel,
I'm sure you're a nice girl. You must know I am doing you a favor. With your kind of background, you will be miserable in this family.
Stop insulting Rachel's family when you don't